The coronavirus or coronavirus. Is it? Chuck Schumer apologized? I don't believe it. Call that an apology? Yep. Bloomberg spent about $500 million.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Translate that, 300 million citizens.
Did it go to a
Can
win?
Can you do that? Mm. And we got Christopher Caldwell.
Oh, you want to stick
around
for that.
The Age of Entitlement.
Yeah.
Now, this interview is about 18 minutes long and it barely touched the justice of what this book has in it.
I mean, I have to agree.
There's a lot of content there.
It's a great book. I've been telling everybody. I got a copy for everybody for Christmas already.
Hey, y'all. Thank you for joining Cross Politics on the Fight, Laugh, Feast Network. Have you joined the club yet and got your Fight, Laugh, Feast shirt? All new club members get a Fight, Laugh, Feast t-shirt. And if you upgrade, Lord bless you, you also will get a Fight, Laugh, Feast.
Hey, did you see that picture of that guy with the Fight, Laugh, Feast?
In Nashville,
doing cleanup work after the tornado. I think he's a headmaster of a classical school in Nashville.
Sir, salute to you.
And, I know.
So, man, we're praying for you all in Nashville as you clean up. But, man, way to be representing
out there doing that work.
Get yourself a shirt.
And we got to update you guys real quick. There's tons in the club portal that just dropped last week.
What did
you
drop?
We have the 2.5-hour interview with David French. It's a hefty one, but
in a Nashville barbecue joint.
It's totally worth it.
Kirk Kennedy, who just dropped the album, he and Maj Touré in Philly.
Fishtown.
And one of our club members apparently has already watched that, and he said, this is too good to be behind the club portal. If you want to sponsor it and let that go public, just call me, and I'll tell you the price tag on that to get it go public.
What did you do? What else did you put up? Walter Williams?
Walter Williams is up today. To Walter Williams officially.
So if you're watching this now,
you should be able to see that. By the way, that was so good.
And you sent us a text yesterday and you said it was better than you remembered.
Yeah, because I was halfway dead during the process
You were getting sick. Yeah, and man, we had so much fun in Philadelphia in Walter Williams,
in his house.
In his living room.
Yeah, it was incredible.
And
I graced his living room.
Godfather Williams.
Oh, man.
He brought the coronavirus to the living room.
It has nothing to do with anything.
No, it didn't happen.
This show is brought to you by Samaritan Ministries. Samaritan Ministries is a healthcare sharing ministry with over 250,000 Christians. How many of those, speaking of Samaritan? Whoa.
Ooh. Why do I get the black one?
I was trying to keep it. Here you go. Hey, it's coming.
You want to trade?
It's coming.
You want to trade?
I kind of like it.
There's a little mug.
Samaritan gave me some goodies.
Some Samaritan bling.
Oh, you know what?
Oh, man.
I'm drinking out of this.
It's not stopped yet. Keep going, Toby.
Samaritan Ministries is a way for Christians to care for one another's needs. It's just like in the Bible. From broken bones to cancer, pregnancies to organ transplants, all without the use of insurance. So, as we enter a new year, it's important to have a routine that incorporates gratitude and remember. Look what you. Oh, man.
T-shirts. I'm just prepping out the studio.
Keep going, Toby.
Man. So it's amazing how often his kindness, it comes through the faithfulness of other believers.
Yes.
Like healthcare sharing with Samaritan Ministries. Every month, members get a notification telling them who to send their money to, how to be praying for them.
Yeah.
And you can even send a note and remind them that they're not alone, that you're praying for them and asking God's blessing on them. So that's how it works, basically. Monthly memberships from Samaritan Ministries, they start as inexpensively as $100.
Oh, wow.
Depending on your age, household size, a membership option you choose. And you can just calculate what that cost would look like for your situation on their website. You can just go there.
Yeah.
Go to SamaritanMinistries.org/crosspolitics.
Just put it in there.
Let them know what we said. This is great because I remember we were sitting down talking to Walter Williams.
Yeah.
And he was one of the things that was
the part of the interview that
broke my heart. We asked him, how do you fix this thing?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And he said, you can't fix it. And you know what we brought up? Samaritan Ministries.
Yeah.
Right. We were talking about how everybody's giving up. He would say nobody's actually trying to stop trusting the government for everything. And we said, there's ministries out there.
A bunch of Christians are getting out of all the health insurance bureaucracy and government programs. Yep. A bunch of Christians are getting out of public schools.
That's right.
It's a little. It's not, we're not.
But God works with little. Come on now.
But God works with little.
Hey.
All right. So Samaritan Ministries, check them out.
Yep.
So Chuck Schumer got in a little bit in trouble this week.
Okay.
Who's Chuck Schumer?
He's a senator from New York, and he blames everything on Brooklyn.
He's like the minority leader, right? Of the Senate, right?
That's
the minority leader, okay?
Yep.
Okay.
I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind, and you will pay the price.
Pay the price.
You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions.
So you see there,
you
at the bottom left,
what hit you.
What rally he's at. Center of Reproductive Rights.
Okay.
And then,
okay.
And then the hashtag upstairs says, my rights, my decision.
Yeah. We can murder babies.
This exactly. is on the steps of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so he's on the steps of the Supreme Court, and he's threatening.
This is around, they're hearing arguments related to the
Louisiana case.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Katrina Jackson is down there, ain't she?
Yeah, right.
We got to get her on the show.
And in Louisiana, all they're doing is saying that if you're going to murder babies, you have to have hospital admitting rights.
So if you're going to own slaves, you need a license?
Somewhat. It's kind of like
that.
You
have to have a doctor. Doctor that can...
So you got to be a professional slave owner.
Right. That's all they're saying.
Regulated by the government.
Right? It's barely anything.
Right.
There's also a side issue regarding whether or not these abortion clinics can sue on behalf of their customers.
Oh.
Which is actually a slightly more interesting aspect.
They're becoming a law firm now?
But think about this. What other business in the world has the right to sue on behalf of their customers? I mean, the incentives are perverse.
Yeah,
absolutely. Wow. Like, we know what our customers want and need.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to sue if you try to prohibit.
Yeah, are trying to in any way. You know, but it's not actually customers. It's not the incentives are all whacked up. So anyway.
So here's kind of Schumer following up on this.
Of course, I didn't intend to suggest anything other than political and public opinion consequences for the Supreme Court. And it is a gross distortion to imply otherwise. I'm from Brooklyn.
Oh.
We speak in strong language.
Oh.
I shouldn't have used the words I did, but in no way was I making a threat.
Well, what happened was he came out and said that. Everybody went buck wild saying, is he threatening the Supreme Court?
Right.
And is it physical or is it?
You won't know what hit you.
Right. So everybody and people are thinking it's physical because he can't mean seats, right, for voting.
Right.
Because this is a lifetime
appointment.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah.
What's going to hit you? What's the deal here?
The doctor's forceps.
Ouch. So
I don't know.
Everybody's trying to. And so Trump came out and responded basically to Schumer after.
What did he say?
Schumer, that was a physical thing, in my opinion. You know, he tried to say, oh, well, that has to do with the election. That had nothing to do with the election. The way he said, we're going to hit back like you've never seen before. That was a real intimidation. And the best you can say is they're trying to intimidate so that the judges vote, so the justices vote their way. That's no good either.
Yeah.
But that was a physical, that was really, if a Republican did what Schumer did, they'd be in jail right now.
Yeah. I don't know. Trump's threatened a lot of people, too.
But you don't know if it's physical or not. You know, but
Supreme Court justices are not pain capable.
You just keep going with this message. But I don't think that he was threatened physical.
No.
I don't think he was threatened physical. No. And I think that it's kind of, come on, guys, let's just be a little fair here. Let's be a little gracious. He was threatening nonetheless.
And intimidating.
Intimidating. Yeah. That was easily intimidation.
And I think while Trump may be overstating, I don't know if a Republican or a conservative had done this regarding a liberal Supreme Court.
He's wrong.
I don't know if they'd be in jail. But they'd be run out of town.
There would be some sort of penalty on the house.
I mean, the mob would be at their gate.
Something does need to be done. You don't go to put it like this. You don't come to my house and tell me what I need to do.
Right.
If you don't have any authority.
And
over
say
me.
You won't know what hit
and
you.
And you won't know what hit you. Because now how I take that is going to be, you know, I'll argue my case
did you,
later.
Did but you get the Roberts
Roberts actually
statement?
Responded to this Rob, whole thing, too.
I don't think I got it. What? Did you give it to me?
No, it was just in the news. Like, you know, people who are paying attention.
Oh, Chief Justice. Oh, yeah. No, I didn't get that video, though.
He's watching the show.
Yeah, I'm like,
what are you guys doing? Like, what are you doing, guys?
Amen. Ba-da-dum-bam.
I don't have that in here.
Come on. No. It's right there. It's come on.
I'm not seeing it enough.
All right, look, I'm just going to read it for
thank
you.
Thank you. Yeah. Pastor Toby, would you please
read it? I mean, it's
you set it up for the next thing. We'll let Pastor
Toby
read it. All right,
you do that.
This is like the...
Hey, we're going to take a quick break and come right back. Right after these messages, we'll be right back. Y'all might be too young for that.
I'm not seeing it there.
basically what he said was irresponsible and he shouldn't have done it.
He said it was a dangerous and direct threat to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm sorry, actually, that was Trump. And then Roberts comes out, who rarely makes public statements, and says, we do not have Obama judges or Trump judges, Bush judges or Clinton judges.
That was to Trump.
What we have is an extraordinary group of dedicated judges doing their level best to do equal right to those appearing before them. That independent judiciary is something we should all be thankful for. And then
that was to Trump. That was his comments to Trump when Trump came out and said, because he came out. Roberts came out. This is what's interesting about Roberts. You're right. He doesn't say much. But when he says it, at least he's trying to be fair. So Trump came out and said, we got a bunch of Obama judges that are out there ruling. They need to recuse themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Roberts comes out then and says, we don't have Obama judges. We don't have Trump judges. We have, what you just read.
Yeah.
So this was that was a while ago. And then he recently just came out.
Oh, here it is. Yeah. I got the statement now.
Yeah.
You're welcome. I got it. It's right here. No worries. No worries. Statement from Chief Justice John G. Roberts Jr. This morning, Senator Schumer spoke at a rally in front of the Supreme Court while a case was being argued inside.
At the moment,
Senator Schumer referred to two members of the court by name, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, and said he wanted to tell them that, quote, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You will not know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions, unquote. Justices know that criticism comes with the territory, but threatening statements of this sort from the highest levels of government are not only inappropriate, they are dangerous. All members of the court will continue to do their job without fear or favor from whatever quarter.
Yeah, so at least Roberts is being fair by coming out and saying something that he should.
One question here. I mean, we talked a lot about the bully pulpit. If you're the governor, you should be speaking this way. If you're, President Trump, you should be speaking this way. Schumer, obviously, he's defending his side. We think he's wrong. He's defending pro-choice and everything.
But there's a difference between defending your side, which is that's just standard operating procedures.
Yeah.
Him saying, if you wanted to stand up there and said, we can kill babies, it's our right. And it shouldn't be taken. I mean, that's all.
Why I think what Trump did Schumer did are two different things.
He can use his bully pulpit, and we think Christians should use their bully pulpits to argue for the truth.
Yeah.
But it's a different thing to threaten somebody that bad things are going to happen to you and try to intimidate them.
Yeah. Is this a little bit like was it Paul going before Felix or where Paul went before the high priest and said something he shouldn't have said, and Paul apologizes, kind of thing?
I think had more to do with dishonoring the office, which maybe there's a little bit of overlap. But I mean, he called him a whitewashed wall or something like that, and then found out that was the high priest. And he said, if I'd known you were the high priest, I wouldn't have said it quite like that.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
But it's true.
Meaning that Paul couldn't see very well. He couldn't see blind or something.
It's possible.
He goes right to the door. Yeah. This guy walks right on the steps of the Supreme Court while they're arguing this case.
Right. You better watch out. Bad things are going to happen to you.
Yeah, I don't like that.
All right, so this last week, the House passed a $8 billion coronavirus bill. $8 billion coronavirus bill. Hang on here.
Stop it.
It started. Trump. Trump was asking for $2.5 billion.
For the wall?
For the coronavirus.
Oh, okay.
$2.5 billion.
And what did the Congress
do? The Congress is like, well, we're gonna. That's not enough.
We're gonna do eight.
We're gonna do eight.
Well, you know why?
Because you never waste a controversy. You never waste.
Because they don't want bad things to happen to them.
What they're trying to underline is they think Trump is incompetent.
Right.
They're trying to say,
the Democrats are. The Republicans aren't.
Yeah,
but Democrats are.
Right.
Sure.
Republicans are just idiots.
So 415 passed 415-2. So a bunch of
I want to talk to those two people.
Two people.
You brave people.
Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona and Ken Buck of Colorado voted nay.
Are they Republicans?
Zilch. I believe so.
Yeah.
Andy Biggs, he says, the reason why I voted against it is because throwing money at a potential serious issue does not alleviate the American people's concerns, nor does politicizing the issue score points for future elections.
Yeah.
Congressional Republicans and Democrats should join the White House in calmly, wisely, and proactively communicating a unified response to their constituents. And he says basically this bill failed to do that. Listen to this. So $8 billion, here's how it breaks out. $3 billion would be dedicated to research development on vaccines, medicine for treatment, and diagnostic tests, including $300 million for the government to purchase such drugs from manufacturers at a fair and reasonable price, because we know the government's really good at fair and reasonable prices.
Right.
$2 billion to help federal, state, and local governments prepare for and respond to the coronavirus threat, including $300 million for the Centers of Disease Control Rapid Response Fund.
Okay. Right.
The Rapid Response. And then $1.3 billion would be used to help fight the virus overseas. So we're gonna.
Well, that's what we do with our money. Yep. We give it away to everybody.
That's right. And then $2 billion to help federal, state, and local governments prepare for I already did that one. $1 billion in additional funds would provide medical supplies and other preparedness steps, like $350 million to aggressively go after the virus in hot spots, like the state of Washington. Governor incompetent Inslee really likes that. Right. $500 million to buy drugs, masks, and other medical supplies. $100 million for community health centers. $500 million to Medicare for remote telehealth consultations on the phone. Telehealth consultations that would help permit sick people to get treatment they needed without visiting.
Here's the question I have. We can question the money, how we spending it. With what's
we
going
should.
On, does the federal government, the way that we understand how the government should work, do they have the right to declare a state of emergency, to use money to do something to help with a virus outbreak?
Yes.
Right?
I think so. Yeah. Right. I think there are some situations in which it is a public safety issue.
That's what I'm asking.
But I think the issue, though, is that
this is where the anti-vacciners hate that.
But that's an extreme.
Yeah.
I would say that's
an extreme. So they're going too far. They should be doing something, though.
The coronavirus is a flu.
Yeah.
It's a flu bug.
It's a different kind of flu bug, though.
It's a new one.
Yeah. It's a different.
That's all it is, though.
Yeah.
And it's like the stats are.
Who still kills people? The coronavirus is killing people.
Well, California declares a state of emergency over this after their first death.
Yeah.
How many people have died in California from the flu this year?
Yeah, way more than one coronavirus death.
Way more. And apparently the governor of California doesn't care about them.
Yeah. He just cares about the coronavirus.
Right. Well, it's the new hotness now.
Right.
It's the new hotness. We don't have any sort of anti-vaccines for this. We don't have any way to treat it at all at this point.
Yeah, the government's got $300 million billion going to
it. Most people get the flu and then their body fights it off.
Yeah.
It's older folks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's people with compromised immune systems that are in danger.
Right.
But that's
the flu.
It's the flu has already killed thousands of more people.
Yeah.
So I think it's way overblown. But yes, does the government have an interest in this? Yes.
So what would you have done? Coronavirus hits?
On this particular one.
Yeah.
I think what you mostly need. I don't know if how much money is in the budget already. I imagine there's already quite a bit of money there.
Yeah.
But I would talk about things like limiting its spread.
Yeah.
Taking reasonable measures.
Yeah.
To do that, and Trump's done that.
So the CDC comes to you and says, hey, you know what?
Yeah.
This is a little different. The way it attaches to the lungs and the way it duplicates itself in your lungs, it takes you. It's a little different. We don't quite have a handle on it. We think you need to shut down the border and spend some money and figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
And you say,
I would need to be convinced of that. But I would say on the surface, I'm not going
to
do that.
What's funny is all the answers that are coming back for how to deal with it. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face.
Yeah. It's like,
well, that's the same thing you tell me with the flu.
Right.
Yeah.
Wash your hands. That's what I'm saying. Don't touch your face.
I think it's a lot of overreaction, but I think the whole point of it though is weaponizing.
Right.
That's right.
Fear.
That's right.
Anxiety. And sentimentalism, but the thing is that there are other people who have the flu who are dying,
right?
And they're being, I think it's evil what they're doing, because I think what they're doing is they're taking advantage of a moment to basically throw rocks at Trump and his administration.
Absolutely.
Well, we think too, if we can spend enough money on something, we can solve the problem, and that's just not the case. We still don't have a cure for the common cold. So you expect me to believe that you spend $8.3 billion, you're going to get a cure for it? It doesn't work like that.
No. So, you know, North Korea had a leader who went to China, came back, and he's supposed to be quarantined for 30 days, and he came out and went to a public pool, and Kim Jong-un shot him.
Right.
Well, finally, North Korea got their first case of actual coronavirus, and they shot him.
Yeah.
So they don't have any more cases. Well, that's one way to police the ranks.
Yeah.
All the other stats they're getting from China and what is it, like Pakistan or something like that?
No,
Iran?
Yes, Iran. Yeah.
It's like, since when do we measure our health and medical care with China
stats
and Iran?
Yeah, one world economy, absolutely. Dude. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Age of Entitlement with Christopher Caldwell. You do not want to miss this interview coming up
just
next.
Just order the book right now. Just order it right now. Get on Amazon. Order it right now.
And get the audiobook. Get it all. World Cross Politics coming up next.
Americans have been traveling down the health insurance highway for decades. But lately, it's been taking us to places we don't want to go. For Christians, it's hard to know which road to take. Or is it? Samaritan Ministries provides a different direction, a biblical path for their members to pray for each other and share financially in each other's medical needs.
This idea that Samaritan has adopted from the book of Acts should permeate all parts of our lives, not just health sharing. we, as a body of believers, are living out New Testament Christianity. This is what God intended for the church.
Do you believe that you need an insurance company, or do you believe that God will provide your needs? And there are people that you've never met before who are going to pray for you and meet your needs. There's another way.
Looking for a new direction for your healthcare? Visit us online at SamaritanMinistries.org.
Oh man, your coffee's so good.
Yo, you're welcome.
Yeah, way to go.
Welcome back to Crust Politic on the Fight Laugh Feast Network. This segment is brought to you by the Chocolate Knox's homemade French press. No, it's our French
Crust Politic coffee.
It's a drip.
It's a drip.
Yeah.
Crust Politic coffee, which you can get at crustpolitic.com. Hey, we are grateful to have with us on the line right now.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Mr. Chris Caldwell. He is the author of this book, The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. He's also a contributing editor at the Claremont Review of Books, a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. He's also previously a senior editor at the Weekly Standard and a columnist for the Financial Times. He's also the author of Reflections on the Revolution in Europe, Immigration, Islam in the West, which I need to get and read next. But this is his brand new book, Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. He's also married to Zelda, and they have 5 children, and now he's even been on Crust Politic.
Wow.
Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Well, glad to be here.
Hey, Chris, did you baptize those babies?
That's a long time ago.
Okay, well, you know, good. We're going to be friends.
Are you a grandfather yet?
No, I'm not.
Okay, working on that.
You know, did anybody tell you, Chris, when I was reading through your book, I started thinking, like, Chris is kind of like a ninja. He kind of comes in, tippy toes around, kind of secret, and then by the end of the chapter, I feel like he killed me.
Yeah. I called it your dagger. I think you got a dagger. I mean, first of all, this book is very well written.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's just a delight to read.
Yeah.
But you walk softly, and then all of a sudden, you just, like, stab me in the gut.
Well, that was not my intention, but I have not been told that, but I guess I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you.
Absolutely. No, in the best kind of way.
Like, no,
I mean,
good.
You know, we kind of like that style. So in your book, you claim that the Civil Rights Act in 1964 effectively created a second rival constitution. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Let me start off by saying something that I don't mean. I think that the book has been kind of widely misinterpreted, maybe in some cases intentionally misinterpreted, as a defense of what came before 1964. And that's really not
sure.
That is not what the book is doing.
Sure.
What the book does is it says that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and this is one of many things the book does, but the most controversial thing it does is that it says that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, because it was such a powerful law, because it was a law designed to overrule, you know, the standard way of making political decisions in the South, evolved over the course of the next 50 and 60 years to become a second way of doing politics. Mm-hmm. That is, it was a set of measures that was brought in an emergency situation. It gave courts and bureaucracies the right to overrule certain institutions and institute things for emergencies. And although Americans thought that was necessary in 1964, they had not expected this style of government to extend to other things besides segregation.
Right.
But it did very quickly. It became a matter for, it became the way we managed women's rights, gay rights, immigrants' rights, handicap rights, and we had developed much, much stronger disciplinary measures. And so it became a second way of running the political culture, and through which the original way we had could be overruled.
Can you explain what's the different ways? So what's the old way, and then what's the new way that was introduced by, you know, even if, you know, accidentally or unintentionally by the Civil Rights Act.
Right. Well, the old way, and it didn't always work on, you know, it didn't always work perfectly, but everyone has a pretty clear idea of how the American system is supposed to work. You have three branches of government. You have an executive in the White House. You have the legislative in Congress, and you have the judiciary in the Supreme Court and the various courts.
Right.
And the idea is you vote, you know, if you can get a majority for your laws, it becomes law. The president signs it, and the Supreme Court looks at it and says, yeah, that's okay. The new system of laws basically was something that worked between the courts and the agencies that worked under the president. Mm. So I'll give you one example. Bilingual education, okay? There is no law on bilingual education. What there is a Supreme Court decision called Lau from 1974. And once it was passed, the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Health Education and Welfare started writing rules about how bilingual education should work. Mm. Once those rules were written, they became the subject of more lawsuits. Those lawsuits benefited more rules. And so now we do have a system of bilingual education without anyone ever having voted on it.
Wow.
Another example is, you know, we don't really have an abortion law. Mm-hmm. We have Roe v. Wade.
Right.
You know, I mean, abortion entered most Western, you know, countries and, you know, sometime in the 1970s, as it did here. But in most of these countries, there was an actual vote. Not here.
Right.
And the fact that we didn't vote on it means that the Supreme Court becomes a political football. And that's just one of the negative consequences.
Chris, I can just hear the outcry. I'm sure you've probably already experienced this, of everybody saying, but the old way didn't seem to really work for all people. So
that's right.
You know, while we, you know, we do see, I do think I do agree with you that the Civil Rights Act definitely brought in a new way of doing things, and I love how you wrote it, but I'm kind of wondering what's the alternative then to make the old way work for all people.
Yeah. And this is not what my book focuses on.
Right.
Although I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah.
I think that in the early 60s, rightly or wrongly, most Americans who looked at the problem of civil rights looked at it as a local problem. What the problem they thought that they were solving was segregation. They thought they were solving Jim Crow.
Right.
And it's tough to tell, you know, exactly where the stopping point. I think that people thought that. I think that as long as the federal government was in the business of ending jure segregation in the South, it was on totally solid ground.
Hmm.
I think that to the extent they could find de jure segregation, and by this I mean segregation under law.
Right.
To the extent they could find segregation under law in other parts of the country, on solid ground, getting rid of that. It's when you got into the judgment calls, like, for instance, whether to bus, you know, kids out of their neighborhoods in northern cities, you know, where the segregation was de facto. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't a problem. It might have been a problem.
Right.
But whether it required federal intervention, this suddenly became a question on which people were really divided. You were no longer, you know, you were no longer talking about the consensus that you had for fixing the problem in the South. Now you had, you know, two sides to the issue, and I think that that's when the country began to divide.
One of the things that you trace really helpfully in this book is all the economic impact of the Civil Rights Act, and then sort of the, it kind of snowballs, you know, sort of an avalanche of things that, you know, if the government then has to provide this, then they have to pay for that. And if they have to provide that, then they have to pay for that. Can you trace for us and for our audience some of that economic impact of this way of doing politics?
Yeah, I think that you know, certain worthwhile things in politics are worth spending money on, you know, I mean, so I don't want to say this is a, you know, the fact that this was expensive is evidence that it was not worth doing.
Sure.
But as I say, the book is about how these laws spread and the expectations people began to have of them. And basically I would say that by the end of the 1970s, you had a very large state built out that was kind of aimed at the transformation of the country. And you can call that, you know, the Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, or
sure,
you can call that a welfare state or whatever. You had a very large state. And ordinarily you'd think the natural thing would be, well, we either got to figure out how to pay for this state, or we've got to cut it back, mm-hmm. you know? And that was where the state of the argument was when Ronald Reagan was facing Jimmy Carter in the 1980 election.
Right.
You know, Carter basically stood for defending Lyndon Johnson's state. Ronald Reagan stood for cutting taxes and paring it back. But something very different happened. This state actually had its defenders, and it had a lot of defenders. There were a lot of people who said, look, we had this very serious problem with mostly with segregation. There's really no way we can sort of eliminate these programs and believe we're fair. And I think that the political forces behind that position were strong enough that it was impossible to cut the size of the state. So at that point, you would think that we've lost. We've got to raise taxes and find a way to finance it. But no, what actually happened was that the people who did not feel themselves to be benefiting from those programs said, well, we want our stuff too. And that stuff was delivered in form of tax cuts. Mm. And it actually was really effective for a very long time. I mean, Reagan made people very happy.
Yeah.
He reduced the cost of government without sort of reducing the things that government gave. The problem only came later when it became time to pay for those things. And I think it really only became apparent after the crash of 2008 that we had fewer resources than we'd had before.
Wait, so you're saying that we didn't start paying for the stuff that Reagan did until 2008?
Roughly. You know, it seemed like, I think that a lot of people say, look, well, wait a minute. We have been running these deficits pretty consistently since Reagan. It was Reagan who started them, but no one has ever really managed to fix the deficit. Huh. But there's one exception, and the exception is in the 1990s,
did you say
the
Bill
federal
Clinton?
Government brought the yeah
okay.
Bill Clinton yeah. brought the budget brought the federal budget back into balance. But I think that people now understand that the way he did that was that he opened up a lot of private credit, so that a lot of the debt that used to be in the form of federal budget deficits, it wound up being in people's bank accounts, you know, and in their mortgages, and there were consequences of that too. But we're still underwater in terms of the you know of the debt. We're still getting more than we pay for out of our government.
One of the most helpful chapters in the book, actually, I found was the one on sex and the sexual revolution.
Yeah.
And actually, the reason why I found it helpful was because of some of the economic stuff you brought into the sort of breakdown of the traditional household and marriage and the, you know, roles of men and women. You know, we're a Christian podcast. We spend a lot of time talking about the sexual revolution and the problems that it's brought. But I think one of the missing components often in our discussion of that matter is how the breakdown of the household created certain kind of economic incentives and penalties that actually encouraged the sexual revolution. And I thought your chapter hit that really well. Can you trace some of that for us?
Yeah, this was a real revelation to me. It was very interesting to read through.
Yeah.
You know, the attitudes towards the family in the 1960s. If I had to name the most interesting thing that I discovered in the 1960s, it's that during the Kennedy administration, say in 1962, if you asked American women questions about anything,
yeah,
and I mean about sex, about politics, about society, the married women and the single women would give you exactly the same response. Mm-hmm. And they would give exactly the same response whether they were young women or old women. Mm. It was kind of a single culture of femininity and family in this country. So, for example, you know, if you asked, you know, whether there were such a thing as women's intuition. Now, I mean, I don't know, you know, whether you consider this a superstition or a truth or something.
Sure.
But 90% of married women said there was, and 87% of unmarried women said there wasn't. I mean, they were very close. If you asked whether it was okay to have an affair under certain narrowly defined circumstances, about 16% of married women said it was, and about 15% of unmarried women said it was. No difference.
Yeah.
Today, by contrast, if you ask women questions about, you know, anything, abortion, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, married women are extremely conservative, much more than they were, you know, 60 years ago. And unmarried women are extremely progressive.
Yeah.
More than they were. To think of two groups that differ more.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Christopher, I could talk to you probably another 40 minutes because there's so much here. This is why I recommend everybody go out and get The Age of Entitlement by Christopher Caldwell. But I want to end here. I want to ask you, towards the end of the book, you say that the way for Republicans to move forward back to an idea of freedom is to repeal the Civil Rights Act. And when I read that, I was thinking, boy, you must want people out in front of your house burning crosses.
Yeah, I think that actually was, I think that passage has been a little bit over-interpreted. you know, what I, you know, but I mean, what I do say, I'm not trying, that is not my counsel, and that is not my position. Okay. What I said was that this has created, that the law has created, the law is what has created,
yes,
a lot of our polarization.
Yes.
That Democrats can't really see that, you know, doing this thing and sort of expanding rights throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and this century has cost a lot of people a lot of what they thought of as their essential rights.
Yeah.
And they still don't see that. Republicans don't see that if you want all those rights back, you've got to go back to before 1964.
That's right.
And what I'm trying to show, okay, I'm not sort of urging any project on anyone. But what I'm trying to show is how deep-seated the polarization is in this country.
Yeah.
Because I don't think either of those things is going to, I don't think either side is going to give way on what they're saying.
Right. Wow, that's just a really hopeful place to end. I'm encouraged.
Well, Christopher, we have to have you back on, man, to talk about this maybe some more, and then what you got coming up next. That'd be really good to have you back.
Yeah, this is a great book.
Please go out and get it. Yep. Everyone should have a copy in their library.
Absolutely.
Christopher, thank you for being with us. More Cross Politic when we come back.
At Logos Online School, we believe learning should be accessible. Homeschooling shouldn't stop you from staying connected. Enjoy classmates from across the United States and the whole world, coming at you 4 days a week and 32 weeks a year. We believe learning should be engaging, a group of like-minded students who love God and their classmates. Learning should also be customized, with more than 50 different classes offered throughout the day. Take one class or join us full-time. We believe learning should be inspired. Our knowledgeable instructors enthusiastically engage the students. The goal? Hearts that love learning. Lastly, learning should be affordable. Committed to making Christian education reasonable for all families. From $620 per class for an entire year to $2,232 per year for full-time students. The best option on the market. Join us at Logos Online School.
Oh, you're doing your reading now.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, guys, this is really good.
You're supposed to read before the interview.
He said that?
I gave you that book before the interview.
Yep.
Yeah. No, now you're like, oh, wow, this is kind of good.
I'm reviewing.
You were actually kind of quiet, man.
Yeah,
you,
I was.
You asked one question.
We had some technology problems going on that I was trying to solve.
Is that what happened? You weren't here.
I was trying.
I thought you were just being polite.
It makes sense about the opening of the show now. You weren't here.
I was trying.
You?
No, I wasn't.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it.
I wasn't. All
right, just doing other things. Hey, yep. Christopher Caldwell, guys, Age of Entitlement.
Can we get him back soon?
We need to. We need to. Actually, you said this on the break, but we need to do
a master class.
We need to do a master class. We need to sit down with him. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, we need two hours with him in a coffee shop.
We really do. Yeah. We got to figure that out.
Yeah.
Because there's so much we didn't even get into.
It's really good stuff. I mean, even after we got off, you know, off the show, we talked to him a little bit longer. A
little bit.
And, man, he just keeps going.
He was far more sympathetic. And I noticed this when we asked him a few questions about the civil rights movement. Yeah. I can see, because when I read this, I think I told you guys before we started the show, I can see people right now going like, okay, do you not want black people to vote?
Right.
Like, did you not right. see no, the no. problems that we're no. having right now? And he's picked up on that. And I think he's done a good job. He's sensitive a lot more to the civil rights movement of the morality of what was going on. But he's really trying to say, what we gave for the answer did not lead us down the road of what we thought.
And what a majority of people, I think, thought that they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Which is everybody, that's what everybody misreads Doug the same way.
Yeah. There's a lot of, so everybody knows, and you pointed this out, that the basic claims of the civil rights movement, MLK,
right?
There was a moral high ground.
Yeah, there. I got that from Doug Wilson.
Yeah. Everybody know. Well, I got it from you.
Yeah, we're all stealing.
No, but everybody knows that there was a basic moral high ground because there really was racism.
Right.
There really was prejudice, and some of it was just cultural.
Yeah.
It was de facto.
Yeah,
and some of it was de jure.
Yeah.
It was actually on the law books. Like, if you're black, you can't buy a house in this neighborhood.
FHA loans.
Or you can't be in the city limits or whatever. And other, you know, voting restrictions, red lines.
From this water fountain.
But that's kind of like, that's the genius a little bit behind the whole civil rights thing is like the government had actually legislated a lot of discrimination. And then they come in and fix it.
But let me finish this.
Themselves? Okay.
Let me finish. So the point is, though, is that there's a moral high ground.
Yeah.
I think the majority of people in America said, okay, this is not right.
Yeah.
We got to fix this.
Yeah.
Right.
But what happened was what got delivered was way more than they thought they were asking. But they said, can you fix this?
It's like, give me a king.
Which is kind of problematic.
Well, because the same
we want
people
a king.
Who were, this is what Gabe was getting at, I think, though, is the same people who messed up the system, the thieves, said, hey, could you fix this for us?
Yeah.
They're the same people who broke it, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so part of my problem when I started first going through Caldwell's book was I was thinking to myself, what did you want the alternative to be? Because the way that the Civil Rights Act was implemented basically had the education of what came before it that was laying out the problem that we had in civil rights.
Yeah.
So the people who are saying we can fix it now are the same people in one sense or another that had laid out the laws for segregation.
Well, there was with some variation because you have the difference between states and feds.
Sure.
So most of those laws were on states' books.
Right.
And so the big significant change, though, is that we ratcheted that up and we gave it to the feds to fix.
That's like Civil War again, though. Let's go back to the Civil War. You got states
which I think an argument can be made that in the Civil War, we in principle were inviting that.
Yeah.
Because at the very least, they put the gun to our state heads and said, you can't leave the plantation.
Yeah. Right.
And so there's at least a principle there. But I think Caldwell's point is that constitutionally thereafter, everybody thought you could kind of, you know, okay, we did that, but let's just forget about it and go back to the way freedom was considered before.
Right.
But at the Civil Rights Act, you actually had
a mental shift.
They
shift.
Handed that all sort of officially to the feds.
Right.
And then as he pointed out in the interview, the Supreme Court in particular
ran with it.
Started really running with it.
And then what happened in 1973?
Yeah,
7 years later. Eight years later.
And here's the thing.
Yeah.
Just really in a nutshell, he didn't quite put it this way, but my takeaway is that the real shift that happened was now the idea of rights and freedom is something that the federal government
just about
gives us.
Has to give you.
Preach that.
And so it's not something that you have by right, by virtue of being created in the image of God.
Yes. Right.
That's prior to the existence of any government. But rather, it's something that the government makes sure that you have and guarantees to you.
Yeah.
That's the shift that happens.
That's right. That's So Black History Month, me and my family have been watching movies for Black History Month ever for our Friday night movie.
When's White History Month?
Y'all got that for the rest of the 11th month.
Did you include Steve Martin, the jerk, in that one?
Sure, whatever you want. But during that time, though, we were talking about the whole Civil War, the Civil Rights, and that time. And I said, you know, and he's helping me frame this. I'm not quite settled on how I think about this. But I think what should have happened after we won, because I think we did, the Civil Rights Act showed that we won the argument that something was wrong and we need to do something about it.
Right.
But what we shouldn't have did is said, now let's make a law that allows Black people to have all the same rights. Like you said, giving it to the federal government.
Right.
Instead, we say, wait, you don't have the right to do that, sir.
God gives.
Just in the same way you don't have the right to take away.
Right.
For me, you don't have the right to grant either.
Right. So what happens is any disenfranchised group or a group of people who feel like they're disenfranchised, then they start lining up.
Right.
So you have the Blacks who say we're being mistreated and the government says, okay, so we're going to help.
Create another group of class.
We're going to run around with you
and
make sure that everybody's treating you right.
Yeah.
Right. And which brings with it a bunch of money because you got to pay for all those buses. You got to pay for all the people that are going to regulate it.
Well, at least treat it in the same. Well, I want to be careful about this somewhat because there are some things where it's like, I just want you to apply the law that you're applying to this white man to this other person over here.
But the different, but that
so doesn't, you don't have to run around.
No, but that's what I'm saying. But that's what the Civil Rights Act did, though.
Yeah, it said we're going to watch this special group of people.
It gave special dispensations to a certain race. And here's kind of big picture what happened.
It's not just dispensations. It's bureaucracy and administration of the government to enforce it absolutely. And run around with it, which is different, though, than the laws being applied unjustly here and going to the court and the court saying, You're right. And then ruling that way.
And so one point here to this. Yeah. So what happens is when you create special laws to be for this class or to help this class, you're doing that at
the cost,
not just the cost, but at the it requiring everybody else who don't get to participate in those special laws to have to support that.
Right. Well,
creates.
Yep.
Okay. And there's something that needs to be said because I don't want people to hear this the wrong way. We are not saying that there aren't things that should have been done.
No, I'm absolutely.
We're not saying that the system wasn't tainted all the way through because there were people.
Well, we pointed that out.
But there are laws. So what I'm going to say is, though, there are judges who are still not judging rightly.
Sure.
And so how do you get your, because this sounds nice in theory, but in practice, it's not operating as easy as we would like it to say. So I want to make that clear because when you have a Black woman in the South who gets raped, gets taken to court, and then the law still doesn't work.
Right.
How do you
so Christians should have easy time saying that's wicked, evil, and that needs to be adjudicated.
But I'm saying there was no hierarchy even for her to go to apart from that.
Right.
So that's why the Civil Rights Act looks like to fix that.
But exactly. No, that's why it was so appealing, and that's why everybody went along with it. So I get that.
Moral high ground.
We had a guilty conscience.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
But what we didn't see was the fallout of what that does.
And so sometimes the medicine is worse than the disease.
Absolutely.
Right. And that's part of what this book basically. I don't know if Caldwell would say it that strong.
No.
But I'm going to say it that strong.
Yeah.
Because what it did give us was a court though that says we have to enforce the moral implications of this legislation.
Yeah.
So it's no longer law. It's not no longer ruled by law and letter of the law, but it's laws that then create these extra
moral dilemmas that the judge has got to solve.
Extra expectations, and they're like, "Well, if this is the case, then we probably do have to bust these kids across town."
Right.
If this is the case, we probably do have to do this, and then now people are starting to live by fear because they're saying, "If I don't do this, somebody might sue me."
Right.
Yep. Because it's and he walks through women's rights, and then right on schedule, the next disenfranchised group, the gay rights and immigrant rights and all these things. Because now, in order to be really free, the government has to send in sort of their administrative team to take you everywhere and make sure that nobody's doing anything.
Well, first, I got to grant you particular.
Yeah.
Well, class, the example that he gave that I think really helped me see what you were saying there was he's talking about immigration, and he said there's immigration reform in the 50s, 60s, and that immigration reform actually made it illegal for companies to hire illegal immigrants.
Right.
So if you hired an illegal immigrant, you could be under threat of losing your business, whatever.
Right.
But the problem is, let's say he used the example of, let's say you're interviewing a Mexican Well, you legally can't ask him if he's an illegal immigrant.
Right.
And then so what happens is if you hire him.
So you have two different competing and contradictory laws.
Right. It made you have to stop and frisk. That's what it did. It made you have to stop and frisk. Yeah. You have to say, are you legal or not?
Yeah, well, you can't say that. You can't ask that.
But because of that, it's kind of like, well, then if I can't ask that, I'm not going to hire you. I'm going to be safe.
And so some people played it safe and didn't hire anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of other people didn't ask. It's like, don't ask, don't tell.
So then, yeah.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And that's more like And that's
action.
Actually yeah. what ultimately wins out.
Yeah.
That's
actually the don't ask, don't tell.
Wins out because everybody's afraid that they're going to get brought up on charges or sued.
Yeah.
For discrimination.
Right. But here's the thing is we as lawmakers don't understand the downstream effects of our laws.
Right. Well, that's what we're getting at. So we were talking earlier that this is the general equity of the law.
You got in trouble recently for some of this, didn't you?
I did. I'm just going to.
General equity. Are you Westminster?
I'm Westminster.
Are you 1689?
We don't really say it Westminster like they do in Texas.
It's hip hop. 1689.
Don't you mess with also. Texas.
Yeah, so the Westminster Confession of Faith on the law, the chapter on the law.
And the 1689 says the same thing.
Okay, so you Reformed Baptist, you're in this boat with
us. Chapter 19, section 4, I think is what it is.
Look at you. Whoa.
Yeah. How about that?
He's quoting the Westminster up in here. But the point is that all laws have general equity.
Right.
Yeah.
They're, all laws are legislating morality.
And have downstream effects.
And imply a culture.
Yeah.
And those are the downstream effects.
That's right.
Or another way of saying this is all laws have catechetical roles.
Ooh. That's right.
Which
is their job.
They're training and they're teaching people to head in a particular direction, either towards Jesus.
Yeah, that's right.
Towards the living God.
Yeah. Paul says that, right? The law was used to bring us.
And it brings us to Christ in a convicting way.
That's right.
Pointing out our sin so that we need a savior. But it is also has a tutor role. It teaches. And it's saying, this is right, this is wrong, go this way. It's a light to your path and a lamp to your feet.
Yeah.
And so, but the Civil Rights Act, the thing that Caldwell points out, is that it had a general equity catechizing effect of saying basically the government grants rights and freedom and it's coming.
Yeah.
It's coming right behind these people. And if you run crosswise with them, you're going to get sued and you might get brought up. I mean, people started. And the thing is he's really helpful on the diversity thing and on the gay thing and all these other things.
Trans, all that stuff.
People started firing people and canceling. So cancel culture starts before there are even any lawsuits or rules on the books.
Because they saw it coming.
Because people are afraid.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, you think about it. We talked a little bit in the interview about the economics of all this. People, I think all the jihad, LGBTQ, stuff. Uh-huh. Like, bake the cake, you bigot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of stuff. Or you're gonna get sued.
Yeah.
It's driven by, I think, a great deal of fear.
Yeah.
Of not wanting to lose money and not wanting to get tied up in lawsuits.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And saying people are getting sued, people are getting wrapped up in lawsuits. I just want to have a business, I don't want to make money.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's greed. A lot of that is, is not having courage.
Yeah.
But there's also just a lot of, I just want to survive. I want to pay my bills. I want to take care of my family.
Yeah. Leave me alone.
I don't want to lose my company.
Right.
Yeah.
And so people start firing people.
Yeah.
Because, who's the Foxfire dude, Mozilla guy that, was.
Mozilla. Yeah. He gave $1,000 to Proposition 8.
For traditional marriage in California and gets let go.
Gets fired.
Or at least, resigns under pressure or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I really like his 50,000 foot thesis. We already brought this up a little bit, but basically how there's now two constitutions in the United States. You have the 1787 Constitution, and then you have the Constitution and how it looks after
1964.
The 1787 Constitution was basically recognizing God-given rights.
1789.
1789. Yeah. Well,
that's right.
1787 was when it started. And it was kind of like the Westminster, but 1689 was started before the Westminster and the Westminster, kind of like that. The Constitution was just recognizing God-given rights and saying, you guys have these.
Right.
The government's not giving these to you. And then in 1964, all of a sudden you have this reinterpretation of everything. It's like, oh, the government now gives you rights. And now we're under this umbrella that we're living in this world where everyone expects the government to give us our Medicaid. Everyone expects the government to give us our health care. Everyone expects the government to give us our education. And that's where we're at.
And if you're not given those things, you're not fully human. That's what happened with Obergefell.
This is Bernie Sanders. But yeah, right.
Exactly. Obergefell decision said that a marriage, it implies, and he actually gets there. He says this in the book. He says that the Obergefell decision implied that rather than marriage being something that is natural to the human, to creation and God-given, it basically assumes it's something that the government bestows
to make you human.
To make you fully human.
Sounds like the trans argument.
I want to say, though, the civil rights movement ideology and the Civil Rights Act, they ended in two different places. The movement, again, having the higher moral ground was really pushing towards letting us be who we let us be.
Yeah. Leave us alone.
Just in one sense, let us alone. Yep. Let us be able to vote. Let us have the same rights as everybody else. But where they ended was basically giving us a special class, right?
So the government has to ensure it.
But it's so that they should have been completely opposed to that because of what they were getting before was the government was saying that you weren't human.
Right.
We don't need the government. No, we need them to leave us alone.
Right.
But I want to say that, again, some of the Constitution difference was the way that we had been treating the Constitution was right in line with where the Civil Rights Act ended, actually.
Was going. Yeah.
No.
Do you mean?
Well, because the same way that they look. Every man being created equal, how we should treat human beings, all that was being lost throughout history. It wasn't like all of a sudden we lost that after the Civil Rights Act came into place.
No.
We had not been acting in faithful line with that for a very long time before we ended up where we are. So I want to say that the way it ended was a discipleship of where we had already been going.
Yeah.
It wasn't like all of a sudden, oh, we lost our values here and then we get 1964, we messed up with the Civil Rights Act. No. We had been messing up and not acting faithful towards that ideology. For a long time, to the point that the government had already said that they weren't human. They had already made a claim about the humanity of a black man. They had already made a claim.
But we had a Civil Rights Act back in after the Civil War.
Yeah, that didn't really go so well.
I know. Right. But I'm just saying, I mean, I guess part of what we won't know, we can't know. It's a counterfactual kind of question is what would have happened, though, had we let it play out?
I agree. I think at that point,
if the Civil Rights Act had merely said, basically, you may not have laws on the books, at least.
I think there was a high proposition inside the morality that was being preached from the civil rights movement that was a moment that could have been revival for America in a lot of ways. We gave up on that because we allowed the federal government to be the thing that led it.
So what we have is government corruption in various ways that's limiting and persecuting particular groups.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to do was get rid of that.
We didn't do that.
But we didn't do that. And instead of doing that, we said the same people that robbed you and mugged you, we're going to put them in charge of making sure that you're human.
Well, first of all, we let them define us before, saying you're not human. Right. And then we let them define us afterwards.
And real repentance would have been said, no, thank you.
We don't want you defining us at all.
We want God defining us.
So what I want to say is the Constitution had already had a definition of humanity. We weren't honoring that when we got up to this point. So no wonder we get the Civil Rights Movement Act that continues to go. I don't want to make complete separations between those two.
That's a really good point. But we needed to repent.
We did need to repent.
And we needed to repent and we needed to say, we don't want the government declaring our humanity. Our humanity comes from God, the triune God and his son, Jesus Christ.
And that's what the Civil Rights Movement should have been.
The main voices in the Civil Rights Movement were either kind of some sort of heretical Christian. I can't think of a strong, faithful Christian voice.
I think there were a lot more Christians involved in it than
the strong voices were not coming from faithful churches. Right.
But some of that's related to the fact that the faithful churches weren't let them in.
Or they're compromised.
That was a judgment that was happening at the same time that we had to have somebody like Martin Luther King to leave the movement.
All right. Since you want to know more about the general equity of the law.
That's a great book to read
By This Standard by Greg Bahnsen.
Yes.
Okay. This is a great introduction to the T word. I won't say it on the show because this is a family friendly show.
You say theonomy?
Oh.
I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud? I was thinking in my head.
You can bleep that out later. Bleep that out later.
It came out loud.
Greg Bahnsen, By This Standard. Find out more. This is where we need to get back to.
Amen.
We absolutely understand that the laws that were given to the Jews in the Old Testament had a specific cultural application, and that cultural application has expired.
Yeah.
That's what the Westminster Confession says.
Sure.
But the general equity thereof, that means that's the moral principles found there, This is from a holy God, a just God.
We need to go back to redefining general equity too.
We got to do some.
Got some work on that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You want to keep going?
I was just gonna say maybe people should become members.
You know why? Because we sat down with Walter Williams for an hour and a half, and that alone is worth the price of admission.
And Maj Touré
from Black Guns Matter,
David French,
and all that stuff. If you're single, get married. If you're married, have kids. And if you have kids, go baptize them. Until next week, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Go fight, laugh, and feast, and gobble up all that fight, laugh, feast content that you get at the app. Become a member.
Buy two books.